If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. In my 21 years as editor of the Health Service Journal, people are always telling me the NHS is being privatised. If it is, they're taking a long time about it. Those are the words of my guest today, the award-winning journalist who, as you may have guessed, has been Health Service Journal editor and reported on the NHS for over two decades. Welcome to The Bunker, Alistair McLellan.
It's good to be here.
Alistair, I wanted to use that eye-catching quote as a springboard into the rarest of events, I think, an adult conversation about the need for NHS reform, warts and all. Can we start with just a very brief overview of the health of our health system? Like, where are the big pressure points and where are we doing okay?
So the NHS is probably in its worst condition than it's ever been. And if you think about it, it's not too surprising that that might be the case. Because if you underfund it for a decade or so, and then you ask it to deal with a global pandemic, any health system is going to struggle. Now, the NHS has been through tough times in the past. Typically, those tough times have tended to affect one part of the service, primary care, GPs, or secondary care hospitals, or perhaps mental health along the Cinderella service, or maybe the IT wasn't good enough, or maybe the buildings weren't good enough. So there was always something, and you had a series of reforms to fix them. What we've got at the situation is this sort of Uber crisis, which is everywhere you look, the NHS is really struggling. Primary care, secondary care, mental health care, community care, obviously social care. And it's almost nationwide across England, Scotland and Wales. So it's not that care now is not better than it was in 1970, because of course, scientific advances, etc. It is, compare care now compared to what it could be, it's the greatest gap I think we've ever seen since the formation of the NHS.
We hear a lot about the pandemic being at the root of current NHS problem. It doesn't sound like that's the whole story. I mean, while there is no doubt that the pandemic exacerbated issues, it sounds like the patient had a pre-existing condition, basically.
Yes, I mean, this is well rehearsed. I mean, if you look at the number of people waiting for secondary care appointments and procedures in 2019 and compare them with 2010, you can see that the performance has got much worse. If you look at the amount of time people were waiting in A&E in 2019 compared to 2010, it is much worse. And almost every indicator that you could look at had fallen, and in some cases significantly so, 2019 compared to 2010. I'm not making a political point. It's just the fact.
The data.
That's what the data tells us.
How badly has Brexit hit the service, in your view? The sort of increased number of vacancies. Some people do link that.
I would say by far the biggest impact that Brexit had on the NHS was the fact it made the workforce shortage in social care worse. Brexit made things a little more complicated for the NHS when it really didn't need things to be complicated. But it didn't have a massive impact like it did on social care, where so much of the workforce basically just left. And it's not just money that the NHS needs. We'll talk about reform and how reform means a lot of things. But really fundamentally, particularly between the years 2010 and 2014, those 5 years, the NHS got an average 1% real terms increase. Throughout its history, it pretty much, it only works on 4% real growth because there's more people, they have more conditions. So inflation in healthcare is higher because of those factors. So you really need 4% real terms growth. And it wasn't like it was 1 year of 1% growth. Yeah. It was 5 years after that. It got a bit better in the second half of the decade, though it didn't get to 4%. So if you perhaps reach the end of the decade and say the average annual average was maybe 1.5 to 2%, that's 10 years of growth in funding being half of what the entire history of the NHS and indeed that of other Western healthcare systems needed. So it's no surprise that we have many of the issues that we have today, you know, and the pandemic, of course, made things much worse in some situations.
Yeah. I mean, we'll devote the second half of the chat to reform. So to take out the rest of, the extraneous stuff, although it's related, what about the strikes? I'm particularly puzzled as to why this negotiation with junior doctors seems so intractable, because you have essentially the same entities agreeing on other settlements. So it's not like the Department of Health and the BMA can never talk to each other. They manage to communicate, but there is something about the junior doctors' salaries that seems particularly entrenched. Why is that, do you think?
It's a really interesting question, because the junior doctors and the government seem to have got themselves into a situation where there doesn't appear to be any way out, as much as either side might like to have a way out. Yeah. They're just absolutely stuck at the moment. I would say this, there's still a lot of ill feeling from the junior doctors' strikes that were defeated. First time the BMA had ever lost in 2016. I think there's the sort of, the BMA always wins, but, because it's the doctors' union, but it lost for the first time in 2016. And I think there was a lot of ill feeling about that. Being a doctor is a great career. Being a junior doctor, to sort of get to be a doctor, is not
particularly.
It's quite a hard slog now. And it's a harder slog. It's always a hard slog, but it's a sort of less rewarding, harder slog than it used to be. And there are more options to go and do other things, i.e., go and work outside medicine. People will pick up right your jobs, or to go overseas. There is a political big P element to this. You know, there's a very significant activist community within the junior doctors committee within the BMA. They enjoy sticking it to the government. There is no doubt about it. On the other side, the government, I think, has decided that if it sort of gives in to the junior doctors, certainly the level of number that it gives in to the junior doctors, then it's basically making a rod for its own back. I think both sides have got themselves into situations which they wish they weren't in, but they are where they are. And personally, it's very, very hard to see a resolution of that particular strike. In some ways, it suits the government to have the junior doctors on strike now, because they can just go, oh, well, we would have met our waiting list targets if it weren't for the junior doctors.
And it's, spoilers, they wouldn't.
Certainly, yes. We'll never know, but yeah, it's certainly not the only factor. And, you know, with the BMA junior doctors, I think there's such ill feeling towards the government now that it's basically is we can't allow them to settle this. We can't allow them as well. We've got to wait till Labour. We've got to wait till Labour comes in. I do fear that when they find negotiating with the Labour government, I think they might find the offer isn't particularly better.
I have read a lot of what you have written, on reform, and that the core of it is an incredible frustration, barely under the surface. But I find it very interesting that you direct that frustration mainly at right-wing politics. I mean, you wrote that those on the right should assist in helping reform the system instead of continuing to indulge in the fantasy of some brave new healthcare world. Now, I will come back to that.
I'd like to stress that that goes just as much for the far left as it goes for the far right.
No, but it's not the same. That's what I want to probe a little bit, because it is interesting to me that you seem to think that chunks of the left are largely incapable of rational thought almost on the NHS, because it is such an article of faith that when we hear the word reform, we absorb the word privatization.
Yeah.
And so it becomes like an instant battle stations thing. So can you explain a little bit to our listeners why those fears of privatization are largely unwarranted in your view?
Well, first of all, we need to define privatization. So, what do we mean by privatization? The way I think most people think of things, they think of a public sector asset which is sold off to the private sector. That has never happened in the NHS.
Mm.
So, what privatization can also mean is people having to pay for things that they previously got free. Now, that's normally that has happened in the health and care sector over the last few decades quite significantly, but mainly in things that we now call social care, used to call it healthcare. Things are means tested or only available on the private sector.
Mm.
Perhaps the most interesting conversation is, and the one where the most substance is where NHS funds are spent with private providers to provide free at the point of care NHS care.
Yep.
So that has increased significantly over the two decades that I've been involved. Still only if you absolutely sort of stretch it to the maximum sort of, you know, definition of what you mean by private, because a lot of them might be not-for-profit, charitable, community-interested companies, social enterprise. But if you stretch that to the maximum, it's about 15% of what the NHS spends on delivering care. So,
but we're not including GPs in that, presumably.
I'm not
GPs are largely private, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you a story about the GPs. So when the NHS was created, of course, the GPs basically didn't sign up to joining the NHS.
Yeah.
They said we would be contractors with the NHS. Over the years, of course, as the NHS has become a beloved institution, GPs have tried to blur that fact as much as possible. Yes, but they are independent contractors. They only really work for the NHS, and they work on a way that sort of pretty ties them into the service.
I was trying to think of it, and I was thinking, let's say in terms of trains, if the government decided that train fares should be free for everyone and they will subsidize them, but left the trains to the franchises, that wouldn't make them any less privatized. It would just make them free. So I guess when you talk about the anxiety of people about NHS privatization, is it about the assets? Or is it about ending up paying for a lot more stuff? Or is it a bit of both?
I think at the heart of it is the fact that most people who work for it, the NHS workforce is very, very big.
Mm.
So it can make a lot of noise, if you see what I mean.
I mean, it's almost 2 million if you include social care.
Absolutely, yeah. On its own, it's 1.5 million. And most of those people don't want to work for private sector organisations, for a range of mostly good reasons.
Mm.
The great concern about privatisation, the real concern, the sort of hub of it, the thing that generates the heat of it, is not wanting to go and work for a private sector type of organisation. I stress, for many good reasons. I think that then bleeds out. So it might sound a bit self-serving to just say, well, I'm just worried about my job, you know. So I think it then bleeds out to, well, I've got to put sort of, you know, a more respectable front on this. So I'll suggest that by outsourcing work to the private sector, that leads us down the, you know, thing that you always say, American healthcare type system, you know, and could lead us to a situation where we're beginning to pay for healthcare, which of course aspects of we've been paying for many decades. But that's where I think, if you say where the heart of it comes, I think it's this fear from people who work in the NHS, of which there's a lot of them, that they would be transferred to private sector organisations and get worse terms and conditions. And that fear is not totally unjustified. There are examples where that has happened. So,
Okay, so down to the nitty-gritty reforms, is it fair to say that your general thrust is that we should let go of dogma and look at what there is in other systems that works well, perhaps better, and see if it's something that we can effectively transplant into the NHS without the sort of emotional attachment of it being either, you know, a sort of perfect entity or the ideological attachment of the right on anything being free being an anathema to the free market. So it's a very centrist approach in many ways. It's a very pragmatic approach. Is that a fair summary?
Yes. I mean, I think I am very aware of the weaknesses in my position because, I spent 20 years talking to many very, very bright people and the great majority of them very well-intentioned, including, you know, conservative health secretaries and advisors. And, you know, the idea that I might have better ideas than them, you know, all of the people I've talked to, it is a wicked problem. It's a really wicked problem. I would say that those reforms that do work are those which you might broadly call centrist, you know, broadly call pragmatic. That's where there's been the most success. The trouble is, of course, one person's pragmatic approach is somebody else's privatisation or somebody else's state control.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. The NHS is always going to be a political football, always going to be a political football for a whole range of cultural reasons, very little to do with the fact that it's a national health service. If you look at any kind of polling, you'll see that the NHS, support for the NHS far outstrips, even now with all its problems, far outstrips any other kind of institution.
Yep.
Everything else has fallen away. Everything else, the royal family, the church, the BBC, you know, have all fallen away. The NHS stands alone, clearly stands alone. So every political party has got to find a way of sort of showing its love for it. As a Tory MP said during the reforms of 2010, when it comes to the NHS, we're all socialists. Dawson Bell, Resolution Foundation chief executive, former Blair and Brown advisor, he described the NHS as route one through British politics.
Yeah.
You have to declare your love for the NHS and say that you're going to invest a lot in it. And then you go from there, if you see what I mean. If you try and take too an ideological approach to it, you'll probably come a cropper pretty quickly. Now, what do the public want? If you ask them, they'll say, give the NHS more money. That's what they say. They might say some things about waste. They might say some totally misunderstood things about numbers of managers. But at heart, they will say, give more money to the NHS. Every government knows that. The NHS knows that every government knows it. I talk to somebody at the Treasury and say, you know, when you have a spending conversation with the department, the great majority of spending departments you know that you, the Treasury, are going to win it.
Yep.
They'll get the odd victory, but, you know, you'll win.
Not the
with the NHS. The NHS always wins.
Yep.
It might not win when it wants to win. It might not win as big as it wants to win. But it will always win, eventually, and to some degree. I wrote a piece a while ago, meant to be deliberately provocative, I think. It was meant to be deliberately provocative, in which I said that people's love for the NHS was undermining the health of the nation. And what I meant by that was that the NHS, or healthcare, sorry, it contributes about 15% to the nation's health. So 85% of factors, housing, employment, education, etc., they are much more
impactful
when it comes to how healthy people actually are than healthcare.
Liz Kendall, I think, says it's become a sort of final intervention thing instead of being a preventative.
So, but the trouble is, so that's a fact. Nobody disagrees with that. The trouble is, because the NHS is so beloved and is and has sort of taken up like squatting like a big toad in the middle of you know, British public life, or a beautiful eagle, or whatever you wanted, whichever way you wanted, whichever animal you wish to conceive it as, you know, it's like, where should we spend money? Well, if we spend money on almost everything else, maybe not education, maybe not defence, sometimes.
Basically, political parties get most bang
for
their buck by pumping money into the NHS.
And, you know, so what you end up doing is making that, insert your own animal here, fatter and fatter and fatter, you know, and better and better and better, or not particularly at the moment, but in general, in relative to other things. And you get less and less money proportionally spent.
To spend on the 85% of factors.
And right about now, because it's an election, because there's not lots of money around, you've got every political party going on and on about prevention. We need to transfer, we need to shift the things, because why do they say that? Not because they believe it particularly. Some of them do, some of them don't. But because they know they haven't got enough money to really shift the performance of the NHS very far, very fast. But I think you've always got to say, when somebody says, well, we want to spend more money on prevention, you're going to say, well, where are you going to stop spending that money? I only take people seriously on prevention when they say they would stop spending money on healthcare, because that's where all the money is. There's no money elsewhere. Everything else is cut to the bone. The only thing which is reasonably, where there's a substantial money to go and get it, is healthcare, which you might take from that to improve prevention services. But of course, you'll have a lag in terms of the prevention services.
And you'll be roasted.
Be roasted. And the other option, of course, is to whack up taxes. When I'm asked about NHS reform now, and I say, well, what does the NHS want? Does it need a workforce strategy? Does it need more money? I say, my answer now, and this has been my answer for the last 18 months, is time. Just needs time. Of course it needs money. Of course it needs a workforce plan. It needs appropriate IT investment. But even if you give it all of those things,
it will still need.
It's still going to take a time.
It's the space to do it.
So, you know, and the endless debates about, you know, should it be nationalised, should it be privatised, should it be blah, 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 blah. Let's just leave it alone. It's had a really tough time. Just leave it alone to get on. Now is not the time to reform the NHS. The NHS, it's not perfect, and I know this because every day I'm down in the weeds looking at it. But the structure's pretty okay.
It just needs recovery time.
It just needs time. But of course, that's a very dissatisfactory answer for everybody.
Okay, so finally, 30 seconds. What's your impression of the probably incoming Labour government, and in particular Wes Streeting? Is that the vibe you're getting, or are we looking at another big top-down reorganisation?
We're certainly not looking at another big top-down reorganisation. Wes Streeting strikes me as a pragmatist. I think he enjoys picking a fight with those on the left and the right because he's that kind of politician. But it's also good politics in the last thing that he wants to be talking about is money because he's got no money.
Yep, yep.
So especially now Jeremy Hunt might be nicking his non-dom idea. That's a very clever piece of retail politics.
Let's see if it happens.
Yeah, if it happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kite being flown as we're recording and we will probably know what happened by the time this airs. Alistair McLellan, thank you so much for your candor and your clarity. Thank you.
Thank you.
These conversations that I know you enjoy because you are kind enough to tell me cost money to make. So please consider supporting us from as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. I leave you with the words of who else? Enyrin Bevan from his essay In Place of Fear. It is no answer to say that things are better than they were. People live in the present, not in the past. Discontent arises from a knowledge of the possible as contrasted with the actual. This is Alex Andreu in the bunker saying over and out.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.